My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Happy New Year, and welcome to the first episode of 2020. And this week, we have a very special interview with one of my cryptozoological heroes, Peter Byrne. Peter doesn't do too many interviews, and at 93, I was obviously quite conscious of not keeping him too long. So as a bonus, we're going to look back at a couple of earlier episodes from the start of Mysteries and Monsters that you might have missed. Following on from Tobias Whalen's appearance on episode 44, we take a look back at episode 14, where we were joined by Seth Breedlove to discuss Terror from the Skies. Then, we return to one of our earliest episodes, when Lyle Blackburn joined us on episode 2, covering the Beast of Boggy Creek, also known as the Folk Monster. Finally, we're going to have a look back to our discussion with Ron Moorhead, when we covered the Sierra Sounds, all the way back on episode 21, and Ron kindly supplied us with some of the Sierra Sound clips, and we cover a couple of those in the excerpt you're going to hear. So as we enter 2020, we're going to continue our commitment to keep bringing you some of the best guests covering the paranormal, ufology, cryptozoology, and Fortean subjects, so I hope you continue to enjoy the show throughout the new year. Before we dive into the recaps, don't forget to follow us on Facebook with the Mysteries and Monsters page. We're on Twitter and Instagram as Mystery Monsters. And you can subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is under Mysteries and Monsters. Lastly, don't forget to leave us a nice review on your podcast app to help the show continue to grow. December was our best month with the most downloads and the show being heard in countries all around the world, which continues to just stun us, really. So thank you very much. Right, so first up, it's back to episode 14 with Seth Breedlove. I'm talking about Terror from the Skies. When you talk about it in cryptozoological circles and things like that, some people just tend to dismiss this subject completely out of hand, straight away.
Sure.
Was that a challenge when when you're planning these films, when you looked at the subject matter, Seth? Is it something you went, ooh, this could be a bit iffy?
I need to get better about that, strangely enough, because I feel like I don't ever consider like the commercial value of a project. And I was just like, I had always kind of written off the Thunderbird thing myself as being, sort of absurd. And I don't consider myself a huge fan of like flying humanoid stories and that kind of thing. I love Mothman and that West Virginia story, but the Thunderbirds and that never really had piqued my interest until I read, it was actually during some of the preliminary research for Mothman, Legacy. I was reading some work of Mark Hall that Lauren Coleman had told me to check out. And I found that I did have a fascination with Thunderbirds, and then it's kind of grown since we started making this movie. And I'm to the point now where I could totally buy into the idea of Thunderbirds being a real thing. Mm-hmm. Just because, if you write out some of the less or some of the more fanciful ideas of what a Thunderbird might be, you're basically just left with an abnormally large bird, mm-hmm. which to me is totally – you know, I can buy into that. I could see that being a realistic cryptid. So, but as far as like, I mean, you had to educate. The problem with something like Terror in the Skies versus something like On the Trail of Bigfoot or Minerva Monster or Boggy Creek Monster is you had to – so much of it is education. Hmm. Like you're educating people on the phenomenon itself because most people aren't even aware. Like a general audience is not aware of flying humanoids and cryptids and flying cryptids and things like that. They might have some familiarity with Bigfoot because of – pop culture, but they have no idea about Thunderbirds. So you spend a lot of time on a project like this just educating the general audience as to, you know, what the subject actually entails.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I've always found fascinating, primarily because it's one of those subjects that once again, you know that creatures such as giant eagles existed in the fossil record. We know they existed.
Yeah.
And we, you know, obviously we still have fairly sizable birds. I mean, your wandering albatrosses are enormous. Your Andean condors are enormous. Obviously, we've still got things like ostriches running about, mm-hmm. Despite the fact they're flightless. So for me, it's always been, you know, like you refer to there, once you sort of trim it down, what you are essentially talking about is a freak giant bird. That is it. And that's not beyond the realms of possibility.
Right. Yeah, that's what appealed to me about it, actually. And then there were the little strange sort of similarities or synchronicities, if you want to use that suddenly overused word that the paranormal community has decided they adore. there were some strange synchronicities between Alton, Illinois, and Point Pleasant that kept coming up, and even leaving out Point Pleasant, there were some weird things that popped up that strangely sort of connected Thunderbirds and cryptids with just sort of Alton history. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's a town that is known for birds. Like when you go to the town and go to their visitor center, there's eagles everywhere, and the eagle, like pictures of eagles and paintings of eagles, and they're positioned directly next to giant murals of the Piesaw bird and paintings of the Piesaw bird, and they have town T-shirts that say, you know, Alton, Illinois, and the Piesaw bird is on the T-shirt. So it's just kind of strange how their legends sit next to their you know, their known sort of animals so easily. And then there's also the fact that the town is known as the guy's name completely escapes me now. But at one time, the tallest man in the world lived in Alton. Robert Ludlow. Rodlow. Yeah. How is it? What is the last name?
Ludlow. I think I pronounce it Ludlow. That's always been my
Ludlow.
I could be completely wrong, Seth. But
no, I think you're right.
He's one of those things. He's one of those people that it's all down to the Guinness Book of Records. I know who that is.
Right. Yeah. No. So I just thought it was cool. I thought that was a nice, strange synchronicity. God, I hate myself already for using this word so much. Between that and then sort of the idea that, well, maybe like Robert Wadlow, maybe there was just this massive bird, you know, that flew through Alton in the 1940s and was seen by a number of people. But I mean the entire subject of winged cryptids is strangely present in that state, in the Prairie State, and I don't know why that is. It is a state that seems to like birds. And even when we went down to shoot Momo a few weeks ago, we had to drive through. I mean, you drive through the entire state of Illinois, and actually, we're only as the crow flies, you're probably only 45 minutes from Louisiana to Alton if you go down the river. So we were very close to where we'd been before, and coming over, crossing over the Illinois River into Missouri from Illinois, there was a giant some sort of nature refuge or something like that. It's a state-run nature preserve, and there on the side of the road was a massive you know, sign that said Illinois. I forget what it was. I forget the actual name of the place, but there was just birds all over the sign. And, you know, it puts you in the mindset that like, this is a place that I'm not indicating that every single, you know, person in the state of Illinois has had a Thunderbird sighting, but they've definitely sort of as a state, they seem to have embraced birds, giant birds or not. But they like their eagles in that state.
Yeah. It is interesting because, to be fair, I didn't know much about Alton at all. And it's interesting that you refer to the similarities with Point Pleasant because it seems a very similar town. You know, the whole feel of it, the way it looks. I think when you're doing one of the shots, when you're talking about some of the sightings, it's very reminiscent to, you know, the TNT area outside Point Pleasant. You know, there's like some kind of giant cement factory on the river.
Sure, yeah. I think the biggest difference between the two seems to be that Alton is thriving. I don't think that is a town that I would point to and say it's in dire straits or anything like that. It's one of the probably most successful, at least to my eye, small towns that we've been to lately. And, you know, whereas Point Pleasant, you can definitely see they've seen some better days, but the history of the two, leaving out anything seemingly paranormal or supernatural, and you still are left with startling similarities between the two towns. You know, they're both river communities. They both have that sort of history that relates to Native Americans, and they've both seen their fair share of local tragedies. You know, like the flooding is another similarity between the two. But then when you bring in something like their winged bird history, it is interesting that they are so similar in so many different ways. Troy Taylor, who we interviewed in the film and is sort of a renowned author and ghost hunter, or I don't even think he would refer to himself as that, though, historian of ghosts, however you want to put it. But he refers to Alton as the most haunted town in America. And I've heard people toss that around relating to Point Pleasant as well. So however you want to connect the two. And we don't, you know, in the film, we're not trying to draw any parallels between Point Pleasant and Alton relating to, you know, being some sort of magnet for like winged cryptids. We're not doing that at all, but we are pointing out at least, and really when I say we, I guess Troy is pointing out that there are similarities you can't really just overlook.
Yeah, very true. I mean, that bit, that's another point at the beginning of the scene is because Illinois is one of those states, I think, that outside of America, it's probably, other than Chicago, nobody knows anything about Illinois, really.
Right, right.
And so when you're looking at some of the vistas that you're using in the film, it is a stunningly beautiful place with a really varied geography and topography.
That was such a happy accident, too. The storytelling device that we use in this film it differs from something like The Bray Road Beast or some of the other movies where we broke it up into chapters like Beast of Whitehall. In this one, it's broken into three sections. Each section is sort of informed by the geography of where it takes place. So, you know, the first chapter is Southern Illinois, the second chapter is Central, and the third chapter is Northern Illinois. And that all came about in the editing of the movie, just kind of finding that device and thinking that would be a nice way to sort of tell that story. So I was actually stunned with how the geography changed. And honestly, when we filmed Momo, we saw it on an even larger scale because when you head further west, when we did Momo, Terror in the Skies, you're more down on the southern, you know, direct southern sort of border of Illinois. And when we made Momo, you had to drive from clear from the western part of the state, or eastern part of the state to the western part of the state, and down. So you're kind of moving at an angle that gives you a much better view of what the entire state sort of looks like and how that topography changes. And when we got down into that Mississippi River Valley, the Illinois River Valley, that's where I was really stunned by, you know, at one point Troy Taylor says there's mountains in Illinois. And when he said that, you know, I had never seen any evidence of that until we were making Momo and we had to drive down to Missouri. And then I was like, oh, there legitimately are like mountains in Illinois. It's a strange thing to see. Here in Ohio, we would refer to them as foothills.
Yeah.
And obviously in a place like North Carolina, you know, or Colorado, they would laugh at them as being mountains, but they're mountainous. I mean, they're definitely not hills. So that was cool. And it's just you're right. Like I actually hope that this acts as a really, really good introduction for viewers to the state itself, to the state of Illinois.
Don't forget, you can find all of the Small Town Monsters on Amazon Prime, so go and check them out. Now, the next clip, as we mentioned, is Lyle Blackburn, who will be returning to the show in a few weeks. And here we're covering his love of the folk monster.
It's one of those things that, for me as well, because obviously I know the story and I've seen the film and obviously was fully aware of it. When I found out that obviously your book had come out and read it, I was, you know, as you say, I was stunned to discover that nobody else had really gone after it. And I can't really understand it now, unless people who saw the film just thought, well, it's just a film and that's it, and didn't really look past the entertainment aspect of it and just thought, well, here we are, we've got a monster movie set in the southern states of the US and left it at that. But like you say, obviously the film featured a lot of people who recreating their own sightings and their own experiences, and then it was all shot on in the area and in the actual locations where some of these sightings had occurred. So it was almost like you say, it was probably destiny. It was your favourite story, you loved it, and the opportunity arose, and then there you were. I've just found that really surprising, like you say, that nobody else had decided to tackle it.
Yeah, I think it was lucky, and I without being biased, I felt I could tell the story the best because I'd been there and seen it as a kid. I had the interest in it. I lived in the close proximity and I was somewhat obsessed with it. I remember being, I was on tour with my band at some point, and this was, I don't even know what year, but I was in a truck stop and I saw it on DVD and I was like, oh my gosh, I hadn't seen this so many years. And I think I had a VHS of it or something, but I, you know, didn't have a digital copy, and I bought it, and I had a laptop that would play DVDs, and I would sit in the van and watch that thing every night before we had to get on stage. You know, the rest of the guys were in there, you know, whatever, hanging out at the bar, whatever. I'm in the van by myself watching this film over and over. They thought I was nuts, and I was like, I'm just obsessed with this. So I'm glad that nobody wrote a book, because that just gave me the opportunity to be the one to do it.
And I think one of the strengths of the book is, you know, as you referred to earlier, is that, you know, you've come into that town as a stranger, really, and obviously we can now look back and see what happened, you know, after the original release of the film, where a lot of people were not necessarily humiliated, but as is often the case in situations like this, there was a lot of negative response to the people. So when you got into folk, how did you go around, you know, building that reputation of, you know, and getting people's trust to come forward and talk to you honestly?
Well, you know, at first, you know, I just kind of asked around, trying to find people that, you know, knew something about it or had sightings and things like that. And fortune was with me, because immediately I was introduced to a guy who had been there during all this. He was a teenager in the early 70s, and his mother had been the one that cast some of the original footprints. And he had a great interest in this. He owned a place called the Monster Mart, which is a convenience store there in Fowlk that is the only place where you can see, you know, to have things to see. It's a lot different now than it was when I first went in there a while back. You know, I was quickly introduced to him, and he kind of, you know, drove me around, showed me sights. And then I was introduced to a guy who runs a local museum there that's a historian on the area. And by return, you know, they probably thought I would never come back, but by returning a couple of times and, you know, talking to, you know, the guy at the museum and things like that, he, you know, he knew I was serious, and he then could kind of arrange people to come do an interview, because he would call them and say, look, this guy's, you know, I think he's doing a great thing here, and, you know, I think you should come down and talk to him. So once I had a few key people in town, especially a historian who was kind of on my side, then that kind of opened the doors to for people to talk to me. So, you know, and then obviously once the book came out and everybody read it, and I included a lot of historical aspect about the town of Fowlk, and I just tell the story. I don't try to convince people one way or another. I just say, hey, this is what people claim to have seen, and let me tell you, these people are credible. Here's how it all went down. Once they read the book, they thought, okay, this is great. I mean, you know, nobody's laughing at us. There's no snickers. It reflects what we feel about it. We can't prove it or explain it, but this is the facts about the case. And that obviously now makes it, I can show up in the town and, you know, there's, I know probably know more people there now than I do in my own neighborhood.
Well, I suppose that's a good thing, Lyle, and I think it speaks volumes to the way that you treated the subject as well, because, you know, one of the things I took from reading the book was how respectfully you treated the whole story and the people, because, you know, once you dig into it, it is, you know, it is on the record that, you know, the amount of belittlement that went on to some of the people, and, you know, and the allegations that were made against people like Smokey Crabtree and things like that, that, you know, obviously would set people up for being really wary, especially when it had been put to bed for quite a while as well, for you to then turn up. But like you say, because of the way you were with people, it probably did you find that more people were coming forward because of the way you'd treated some of the original witnesses?
Yeah, I think so. Especially once the book had been out, you know, and then it was, you know, people, I was more known, and then I was on several television shows as the, you know, so-called expert or historian on the case or whatever, you know, which, you know, cast me in a bigger light. And then, yeah, just people would then, you know, share their stories. Or if now, of course, if there's any sort of sighting in Fowlk, you know, if it's all routed towards me, I should have a Foggy Creek hotline or something.
Yeah, very much so.
So yeah, it's easier to get reports now, and people trust me, you know.
I think it's one of those people that, you know, and it's testament to the quality of the book and the work that you put into it, that you've basically become, you know, without wishing to label you, Lyle, as the go-to man when it comes to Boggy Creek and the Fowlk Monster and the stories around it. And like I say, I think that's just real credit to the support that you've shown the town. And obviously, if anything, it's probably helped them embrace that period of their town's history.
Oh, it certainly has. I mean, and the difference between when I first walked into the Monster Mart a decade ago, you know, there was something to see, but not much. There's a mural on the outside of the store. Inside, there was a few newspaper clippings sort of pinned on a corkboard. There was a few books, like Smokey Crabtree's books, were being sold. I'm like, wow, I can't believe this is all there is to see. You know, this is a huge legend. You know, people come from all over to Fowlk just to see it. And now, you know, as a result of not only the book, but shortly thereafter, you know, we did episodes on Finding Bigfoot and Monsters and Mysteries in America and other things. It kind of gave a resurgence and a new appreciation for what is one of the most famous Bigfoot cases out there. And so now, you know, you go to the Monster Mart, it is the outside is a complete new facade with this giant Bigfoot coming over the roof, and that looks like a swampscape with cypress trees. And you go inside, there's like a small museum that I've helped to set up. You can see historical items. There's a, you know, a gift shop and, you know, a display with all my books. And I mean, it's completely different. And, you know, that's due in part to, you know, just kind of the book sparking some, you know, something that has translated into, hey, this is a great part of history, a great part of the legend. And if you live in Falk, you know, people were saying, hey, you know, this is what it is. You know, some people are proud of it. Some people think it's silly, but on the whole, the mayor and everybody else appreciates it and embraces it at this point.
Yeah. So they've learned to love it, really.
Yeah, I mean, very much so. And, you know, we've done a Falk Monster Festival down there for several years, and I've done guided bus tours and things like that. And it sounds like it's being commercialized, but that's really not the case. It's not like, you know, this, we're not building amusement parks and there's not millions of people coming down there. It's just simply people are interested and they want to see these places and they want to come to Falk and, you know, they want to go to Boggy Creek just because it's something that, you know, is imprinted in their own mind. You know, they saw the movie as a kid, or, you know, they want to bring their kids there, or they love Bigfoot and they want to go to famous Bigfoot sites. So, you know, you have all these people coming and it's nice to be able to have something there from, you know, a small museum to a festival to where it makes their trip more worthwhile to come down there.
Absolutely. And I think it's also gives the town a the potential to showcase it. We're not just about Boggy Creek. There is, you know, there is more to us than just this story here. And there's a very, it's reminded me the way that, you know, obviously since your book and the Small Town Monsters documentary, that it's a very similar way to how Point Pleasance has learnt to sort of come to terms with the Mothman and why people come there because of that. For me, I think it's quite a similar situation, that obviously, you know, there is a bit more to Mothman because of obviously what happened with the Silver Bridge collapse. But I think sometimes some of these places seem to think, oh, well, you know, let's just keep it there and not remember it and hope nobody comes. But I think now it's very similar to you know, the way, for example, say somewhere like Loch Ness has fully embraced the culture of having a local legend and a monster in their vicinity.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that reflects modern times where, you know, it's they're not as embarrassed about it, or people don't, I guess more like people don't think you're crazy because you say you've seen things like this. We've seen plenty of television shows where, you know, average people, you know, could be your neighbor. I've seen something strange. So it's not as doesn't seem as, you know, culturally a stigma if you claim to see something like this. So I think as a result, the towns are like, hey, this is, you know, and now it's become part of their history and it just is what it is. And like, you know, Point Pleasant can embrace the Mothman and Fowl can embrace the Boggy Creek Monster. Bishopville can embrace the Lizard Man or whatever. And it doesn't mean they necessarily believe or don't believe. It's just that they recognize it's a part of their town history. And hey, let's have fun with it, you know.
Lastly, it's time to return to one of my favourite conversations of last year, when we were joined by Ron Moorhead. And here we cover a couple of his recordings from the legendary Sierra Sounds, starting with the one known as Rapid Fire.
Right, so let's have a look at one of the recordings you did. This one's called Rapid Fire. So I'll play the clip, and then you can give us some background afterwards, if that's all right with yourself.
Okay. Well, just before, there's two of them talking, I think, in this clip at each other. Mm. At the time, we didn't know if they were, this was in 72, I think it was, we didn't know if they were talking about who's going to come in and eat us, or if they were arguing over the food that was outside, because you don't know what you're dealing with. We're in there. By the way, speaking of somebody hoaxing us, we're all got guns.
Yeah.
And I mean, we're ready to shoot at something if it bothers us.
Absolutely.
And so it would be ludicrous to someone to well, anyway.
Even on that level, just before we dive into it, that alone, you know, once again, Ron, I mean, that would be suicidal.
Yes, it could be.
Right, to the clip, sir. Okay?
Okay.
Thank you. I mean, if I heard that late at night, Ron, you, with the greatest respect, you wouldn't see me for dust.
I mean, well, you wouldn't want to get out of that shelter if something like that was going on right outside of the shelter walls.
I mean, I didn't realize how aggressive one of those voices sounds, because one of them sounds really angry.
Yeah, you don't know either is what you're dealing with. You don't know, and that's why we're all in there with our weapons ready, and... You know, they never crashed in the shelter through those log walls, and we didn't shoot at them, so they kept coming back. And that was interesting times, really.
I mean, was that, you know, as you were saying, the more you kind of came, you got the impression, not, you know, no one wants to make an assumption here, because, you know, we are considering things that, you know, we have no tangible, you know, acceptance that, our assumption that they seem to get used to you was true, but how was the first sort of few days and your first few interactions of a similar nature in that kind of aggression coming through, Ron?
Yes. Well, the first couple of years, that's just how it was. These were made in 72, and those sounds you just heard, and they started all this in 71. So... I say they because we believe there was a family of them up there. Different sized tracks were around. And it was very aggressive during the first. And you can't help but get a little concerned. You know, you still don't know. It's just exciting. You feel like you're in a Wild West program or something. But in real life.
Absolutely. And I think the other, I mean, you know, when we talk about the linguistics of what we hear there, there seems to be an acceleration as well, which tends to play towards an aggressive response, because usually if your conversation becomes accelerated, it's usually because you're excited or you're angry or you're sad. There is an emotional response in that kind of way you would talk, would you not say, Ron?
All their chatter was real rapid, and that's something we noticed between themselves or wherever we heard it. It's just a rapid chatter. And this was also brought out in John Green's book, Apes Among Us. He interviewed a guy named Albert Osman.
Mm.
And Albert Osman was supposedly kidnapped and carried away by a male in a sleeping bag.
Yep.
And was held captive for 6 days. And some people know this story, some people don't. But he said in his interview that they were chattering amongst themselves. There was a male, a female, and two adolescents in this area in British Columbia. And he was held there for 6 days until he escaped. And he goes through quite detail on what he's seen when he's running out, what's going on there. And one of the details that I really took note of was they were chattering amongst themselves.
Yeah.
people, when they hear this chattering, it's something you can't understand. It's real rapid. And it wasn't until 74, which you'll have those tapes on in a few minutes, but when the cryptolinguist thinks that they slowed their vocal mechanism down to possibly trying to communicate with us, realizing we couldn't understand the rapid chatter. Mm-hmm. So they were talking to me or yelling at me or something, and I don't know what they were saying, but I responded back to them and got some really interesting reaction out of that night. And it was just two of us in camp, but it was quite an exciting night. Plus, that was the night I got to see one, which was pretty cool. Been waiting a long time for that.
Yeah, I can imagine. So, I mean, the first time I ever heard the Sierra Sounds as they're now collectively known, I'll be brutally honest with you, Ron, it sent shivers up my spine. So, fair play for you for going back. I think it's the key thing, because I think a lot of people, I mean, do you think that's a lot of people have a similar situation and don't respond to it in the positive way that you did initially, Ron? That they basically go, oh, you know, we're not staying here anymore, we're off.
Absolutely. I hear reports of that all the time. Oh, well, we was out there playing your sounds or doing something, and this thing come crashing through the trees at us. I say, we're out of there. And they're gone. Well, why? You know, these things are just like a bluff charge, I think, when they do that. They never did that with us, never charged in. They were just there and waiting for us to get inside the shelter. But anyway, a lot of people, they do. They'll run away. They call themselves researchers, but if you really want to research, you want to study and see what's going on, what's really these things are all about. You don't run away from them. Of course, when I was 29 when this started, 29 years old, and you're invulnerable then.
Yes.
You think you are, and you think the gun's going to stop them, which I'm not so sure it would have. But you feel comfortable with a 44 Magnum on your hip, and you know all this stuff around you, these other gun power. We'd all been deaf right now if we had to shoot our way out of there, though.
Yes.
But anyway, it was exciting times, and it's still excitement. I was up there last year again.
I mean, it's always been, I've always found it intriguing, and you refer to Albert Osman there, which has always been an extremely peculiar case. More so, I always remember, I think he escaped because I think the one that he considered to be the male was it his snuff he was really intrigued with, and he thought, oh, I'll have some of that, and then he drank loads of coffee and he went on a tiz apparently because he'd had a really bad reaction to it, and Osman was able to escape, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. In fact, I flew up there researching the Albert Osman story with Peter Byrne and Al Berry and filmer. And we flew into Toba Inlet, and we was looking for the place where he claims he was being held, you know, the bowl, the 10-acre bowl, and trying to analyze the time of the year and what he could say he's seen and all that. And I got a whole chapter about that in my latest book. It's quite a compelling story because nobody thinks he was lying. John Green, I talked to John about it, and John said he thought Albert Osman was lying to him. And I said, no, I don't think he's lying. I think he just might have been mistaken about Toba Inlet because it doesn't make sense. He had this Indian row him up the water up there to Toba Inlet, dropped him off, and the timing didn't work. I dropped my airplane down into the canyon and looked out at the 1,000-feet level where he said he could see the ships. You can't see the ships at that level. There's things that just didn't add up for that inlet. So we determined, after all, we talked about it a lot and flew over that area for hours and hours. And we had helicopters on standby at Camel River, so we was ready to drop in there, you know. If we could have found the bowl, then we would look for artifacts, like snuff can leftovers or something like that.
Yeah.
But we couldn't find the bowl, so we determined it was a different inlet, a little closer down, because it made more sense, and that's what I think. I think when John Green interviewed him, which was close to 30 years later, you know, in the early 50s, I think Albert Osman just pointed on the map and said, that's where I was, and looked at the inlet, and it was Toba Inlet. I'm not so sure he was really at Toba Inlet. I just don't think that part adds up. But his story is a good one, and it's pretty much accredited as being genuine because he was so detailed on everything. And so I think he was just mistaken on the inlet, and Of course, Peter wanted to go back up there and then search for it again for the other areas, but again, it takes a lot of time and money and stuff like that to fly my plane around. So I said, well, if you want to pay for the gas, we can go.
Well, fair enough. It's your plane. Your rules, Ron, I think. I think that's the simple.
I'm the pilot.
Absolutely. You get people to pay for the fuel and you choose the tunes, and that's how it should usually work, my friend. So, I mean, yeah, I've always found the Osman case very, just so strange that it's not something you can just dismiss straight out of hand, because it is a very peculiar, it's very similar for me with the Ape Canyon story, because it's so peculiar and so out of place and out of time.
Fred Beck, that was the same year, you know, the Ape Canyon and Mount St. Helens, and he claims he shot one dead on, did not miss, and they couldn't find the body.
Yep. Well, there you have it. Three extended clips. So if you want to go back and hear more of those original interviews, Seth Breedlove rejoined us on episode 14 for his second appearance. Lyle appeared way back on episode 2. And Ron joined us back on episode 21. Now, here's Bigfoot investigating legend, Peter Byrne. Enjoy. My guest today is one of the titans of 20th century cryptozoology. With over 70 years of experience in the field of cryptozoology, I am delighted to welcome Peter Byrne to Mysteries and Monsters. Peter, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Happy to take part in your show.
Oh, thank you. So, firstly, I just wanted to wish you happy birthday, because I believe it's your birthday in the next couple of days.
In a few days, that's right. The 22nd, yes.
Absolutely. So, I mean, Peter, you're one of those people that I've been aware of for decades. You're one of the first people that got me interested in the subject of cryptozoology.
Yes.
Now looking back, you were working in India, I believe, back in the late 40s, and is that where your interest began to peak in regards to the stories of the Yeti?
Yes and no. I've always been interested in the Yeti, the so-called abominable snowman, ever since I was young. Mm. My father used to tell me stories, like bedtime stories, and I was intrigued. And then I was in the Royal Air Force during the war in India and in the Indian Ocean for 4 years. And then immediately after I was demobilized, I took a job with a tea company up in North Bengal. And that gave me an opportunity to get into the Himalaya. With the tea company, we had a 3 weeks break every year. So I took that 3 weeks and made three little expeditions up into the Himalaya, taking along a cook and a few Sherpas, porters, looking for the Yeti. And that's back in the 50s. Yeah. And then out of that came, through contacts, the big expeditions of later on, of the 50s, 57, 58, 59, 12 months expeditions, 36 months altogether, sponsored by a gentleman in San Antonio, Texas, Mr. Tom Slick, and his foundation there, the Southwest Research Foundation.
Absolutely. So did you meet Tom whilst you were on one of your expeditions, I believe, in the mid-50s, I think, looking for the Yeti? And was Tom out there doing the same kind of thing, Peter?
Yes, I didn't meet him immediately. This is 1956, and I was in the Himalaya, and I met some Sherpas, and one of them was Tenzing Norgay, and he's the man who climbed Mount Everest with Sir Edmund Hillary.
Yes.
And he said that an American had been to his house recently and was interested in sponsoring a major search for the Yeti. So when I was back in India, after my 3 weeks up in the mountains, I went to Tenzing's house, and his wife had a small piece of paper, and this gentleman had written his name down, Tom Slick, chair of the Bank of Commerce, San Antonio, Texas. So I wrote to him. This was mid-56. We began a correspondence by mail, and that led all the way up to meeting him for the first time in January 1957, and then starting off from there.
Right. So at that point, Peter, had you sort of returned home, or were you still living out in India throughout this period?
Well, I was away for 4 years. I was home for 3 weeks, 1948. I went straight back to India.
Yeah.
And then the terms of contract for most tea planters, which is what I was 4 years, and then a 6-month break.
Mm.
So my first 6-month break was 1952.
Oh.
And then I came back to the tea company up in North Bengal, but resigned in 53.
Mm.
And okay, go ahead. That's what. If I'm telling you what you need to know.
No, that's fine, Peter. So after that point from 1953, were you then continuing to go back to the Himalayas, or were you had you returned to Europe?
No, I stayed on in Asia.
Mm.
And when I resigned from my tea company, I started a big game hunting company in Nepal, in the southern forests of the country of Nepal, the southwest forests, and set that up. And I did that. I hunted there for 20 years, taking a break, a 3-year break, to go into the Himalaya to look for the Yeti. So I stayed in Asia a very long time, all the way through, right up until the 70s. Big game hunting, and then I had a river running company for 8 years. Then I had a high altitude trekking company for 3 years. And then I got into wildlife conservation when I gave up big game hunting, taking me all the way up to 2012, when I had my last wildlife conservation project out there.
Oh, fantastic. So it's clearly a place that's very close to your heart, Peter, out there.
Yes, I've always loved the country of Nepal. And then when I was during the war spending time in India, I quite liked India. It had a colonial flavor to it in those days, which is all gone now. But well, as soon as I got out of the Air Force, I wanted to go back, and I did. I managed to get a good job and went back there and then stayed there for many years.
Absolutely. So when you obviously started your correspondence with Tom Slick, obviously, you know, he's probably somebody that isn't remembered probably as well as he should be, I think, in what he did, because obviously he tragically died in 1962. But did you find him to be a kindred spirit in regards to your thirst for knowledge in regards to these subjects, Peter?
Yes, he had a very inquiring mind. He was a wealthy man. He had the means to follow up on things. And for instance, he heard that during the war, American Air Force pilots, excuse me, used to fly over a thing called the Hump. That was the lower Himalaya. And they reported seeing an enormous mountain, which they said they thought might be higher than Everest. So Tom Slick sent a team in there to measure the mountain using the autolites, and found out that it turned out to be the fourth highest mountain in the world, not as high as Everest. But he had a very inquiring mind, things like that. And he followed up. He was into all kinds of things like that. And one of them was, at first, the Yeti with me, and then the Bigfoot or Sasquatch mystery over here.
So obviously, it was quite an exciting time, because obviously we'd had all the sort of modern media had sort of jumped on it after the Shipton photos at the beginning of that decade. So did you think that, after those sort of 3 years that you'd been out there looking for the Yeti, the Sasquatch was the next possible cryptid that you could really invest some time looking for, Peter?
No, I'd never heard of it. We came down to Kathmandu after 3 years in December 1959. And there's a whole bunch of letters and cables. And one, there's a long cable from Tom Slick. And he said, "You've been up there long enough. You've done a good job, et cetera, et cetera. I would like you and your brother, if you like, to come to America and help me investigate this thing they call the Sasquatch or the Pacific Northwest, something very like the Yeti, but much larger." So it was the very first I'd heard of it in December 59. So I came over here in January 1960. But I'd never heard of it before that. In fact, the public had barely heard of it. There had been some sightings, and they got into the newspapers in 59. And Tom picked up on those and became curious, came up to the Pacific Northwest here, met with people, met with some eyewitnesses, and then started putting together the project that which I ran for him was 60, 61, 62, until very sadly he was killed in that air crash at the age of, I think it was 48. Very sad.
Yeah, absolutely. And from that point, obviously, I know because there's been many things said about that period, Peter, at the time. And I mean, do you think it was a case of that everybody wanted to be known as the person that could find Sasquatch at that, you know, those early days of those expeditions in the Northwest? Or do you think it was just was it a case of everybody was pulling in different directions in regards to the search?
Well, there was no searching per se, except for Tom's team. Mm. He had put together a team in 59, and it was, it was four men, and their job was to, two of them were in the States here, two of them were in Canada. Their job was to keep an eye, keep an ear to the ground, so to speak, and let him know if there were any sightings, so, and do a little research on the side. And they started up. There was no name for the project in 1959, but probably in the summer. And Tom came out here and met them and put them on a salary and let them have expenses, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Then when I came out in 1960, Tom was dissatisfied with the fact that the way they were working, they were not getting back to him. Mm. They're supposed to send him monthly reports. So we dispensed for those four men, and they were paid off, and they went on their way. And we started a brand new project up in Northern California in January 1960.
So, ideally, were you kind of aware? I mean, obviously, I assume you'd have done your research before you got there, Peter. Were you aware of the similarities between what was supposedly going on in the northwest of the United States and Canada in comparison to the Yeti?
Yes, well, both were a great mystery. The singular interest in the Yeti was that it was a primate and that it walked upright. As you know, nothing in the world walks upright, just you and I, human beings. Hmm. And so there was scientific interest there because the reports from various eyewitnesses across the years said it was walking upright. People think bears walk upright, they don't. Gorillas, chimpanzees, monkeys, they're all quadrupeds. They're all knuckle walkers.
Hmm.
And so we had this thing in the Himalaya which walked upright. So there was great interest. The same thing with the Bigfoot here. It walks upright, the Sasquatch. It walks, it's bipedal locomotion, and this puts it in a special place. Possibility of this being a hominid form rather than an ape. So there's still great interest here, and it's growing, and that's part of it. Another part of it is that the one or two people who have seen it up close have said they could see whites to the eyes. Again, we're the only creatures with whites to the eyes when the eyes are looking straight ahead. Animals, when they look sideways, you can see white. Otherwise, there's no whites to be seen. So the people who have seen the Sasquatch or the single piece of footage that was shot show whites to the eyes. So there's an indication that we're looking at, you could almost say, a prehistoric man of some kind.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, after the expeditions kind of, because I think it was after Tom passed away, I think everything kind of died down for a few years. Was it, did you continue in your own time, Peter, to deal with the area, or did you kind of take a step back from the field for a time being?
No, I closed down immediately. The family closed down, and We were all paid off and given some equipment, that kind of thing. When Tom died, literally within a week, everything came to an end. And so I went back to Nepal and picked up my big game hunting company and resumed big game hunting. I had that job in the background, so to speak. So I gave up Bigfoot research in October 62 when Tom died, and then didn't come back to it for many years, until the 90s, when I was offered another project, this time a five-year project with very good funding, and I got going on that, put it together. And that was 92 to 97,
yeah.
And that was the last big project of the two.
Absolutely. Was that the one that was financed by a gentleman called Robert Rhines, Peter?
No, Robert Rhines is part sponsor. Mm. Robert Rhines owned a thing called the Academy of Applied Science in Boston.
Yeah.
And they gave us some funding and assisted in various ways. They sent our scientists to spend time with us, and as well as which he was his personal friend. No, this one was sponsored by a man in Peoria, Illinois, who owned a sprinkler company mm-hmm. and employed about 500 people.
Yeah.
And I had taken him on safari. And when we'd been on safari, eco-safari, not hunting, while we'd been on safari, we're sitting around the campfire talking about the Yeti and Bigfoot. And when I closed down that summer and was back in the States here, he called me and he said, "I'm very interested in starting a project to look for the Sasquatch." And so he sponsored it. And Robert Rhines was part of it, sponsored it. He gave us the backing of the Academy and that kind of thing, and some funding.
Yeah. So in regards, because obviously looking back at that time, because essentially you were quite standalone, because, you know, we didn't have the internet and obviously the resources that a lot of people have these days. How difficult was it, Peter? Because essentially it was all the major searches you were on were boots on the ground, weren't they?
Yes.
So, I mean, obviously, I think it's difficult for a lot of people in this modern era to kind of look back at the amount of time that you would have had to have spent out in the field. Was it difficult, or what, due to your experience of, you know, your time in India on the tea plantations and the environment and things like that, did you find it easy to adapt to that kind of change?
Yes, I enjoyed it. I didn't find it difficult at all. Now, when I was a tea planter, in those days we had no air conditioning. We had, in our bungalows, we had fans that didn't work some of the time, and we had power cuts. Yeah. And that was a little difficult. Temperatures of 115, 120, and this in the summer, the monsoon summers. Those were a little difficult. And then picking up malaria, the different fevers, a little difficult. But I enjoyed it. And I put in 5 years with the tea company as part of my contract. And then living big game hunting, it sounds rough here, but in effect, you live fairly well. Big tents. There was support and man in camp. There's a cook, good cook and good staff. And so there was nothing difficult about it for me at all. In fact, I enjoyed every minute of it.
Oh, it's fantastic. I mean, obviously, was it the experience, your experiences in the Himalayas and Nepal that convince you that there are these creatures out there, and it's just a case of we just need to get out there and find them, Peter? Or did you kind of just embrace the stories and take it from there?
Well, it was the Yeti. First of all, I think the Yeti may be gone, because all the time I was in Nepal, even if I wasn't Yeti hunting, I was meeting in the hills, meeting with Sherpas, meeting with Tibetan traders, and I'd ask them, "Has anyone seen a Yeti lately?" And up until 2012, my last visit there, no one had seen anything for 30 or 40 years, nothing.
Yeah.
No footprints, no sign of any kind. And to where I believe, like, at least two other animals out there, of which I was quite familiar, they have disappeared. They have come to an end of their cycle, big animals. So I think the Yeti might be gone. With the Bigfoot, though, it's different. The sightings continue, and I'm talking about credible sightings, not school kids looking out of a school bus, and not hippies riding bicycles. sightings by very dependable people, by engineers, by surveyors, by logging company operators, and there are not very many. In fact, there's a big gap recently, all the way back to 2005. Then we had a first-class sighting last year by seven men, thoroughly reliable, thoroughly credible, and another one 3 weeks ago by a lady. So with the Bigfoot, don't ask me how many there are. People do that. I have absolutely no idea. Nor does anybody else. There can be five, there can be 500. We don't know.
Yeah.
But the sightings and some footprint finds are continuing. So I'm enthusiastic that with a bit of luck, we might get some real evidence. And real evidence, it's what science demands, is physical evidence. Mm. In other words, the body on the table, so to speak. Absolutely. So it would be great if we could find one that had died of natural causes, a skeleton, something like that. But out here in the Northwest, where we have millions of acres, and I'm not exaggerating, millions of acres of forest, nobody living, anything that dies is disposed of by the carrion eaters, mainly the bears. Mm. Bears, ravens, crows, porcupines, is literally gone within a few days. We have hikers that disappear out here, and they disappear. They're never seen again. Because when they die, the body starts putting out odors, and the scavengers home in on that and dispose of everything, eating skulls, leg bones, everything. So when one of these things dies, that's what must be happening, have been happening across the years, simply disposed of by scavengers. But there's just a chance that we still might find a body one of these days and then have physical remains as evidence.
Absolutely. I mean, to be fair, Peter, you were probably one of the most vocal critics of trying to, you know, you wanted to introduce the no-kill policy back in the 1970s because I think you understood the development of the field and like you refer to there, you know, we need a scientific provable evidence in regards to, like you say, a body. But I mean, what was it that was there a building demand to actually go out there and kill one at that time, or was it just basically as part of your change in conservation you decided a no-kill policy was the best way forwards?
I've always thought it would be wrong to shoot one of these things. And then people who have seen one up close, they say something which sounds a little odd. They say the face that was looking at them was not a gorilla. It was a human face. It was extremely primitive. The cheeks are bare, large eyes, a big forehead, and suggesting, again, a hominid. So I've always thought it would be wrong to shoot one. We carried rifles a lot over the years because of the bears. Bears can be dangerous, especially if you run into a female bear with cubs. Mm. Very dangerous. People do get hurt, injured, even killed sometimes. Mm. So we carried rifles, but that was our policy all the way through, all the expeditions for the Sasquatch, right up to the present day. I am totally against killing one. And a lot of other people believe the same thing.
Yeah, well, I'm in complete agreement with you, Peter. I find it endearing that I think the only way we'll do this is through proper research. And I think if you end up with people just going out there, you know, hunting them, I think, you know, it's an awful situation to promote, I think.
Yes, okay.
So in regards to the other interesting aspect of the Bigfoot in America is the fact that obviously down south you have a couple of different varieties. Did you have much experience in searching for the skunk ape, Peter?
Oh, I never did. No, I never was involved with that. I did my reading, read the reports, talked to people, and the skunk ape was very dubious. Not credible in my opinion. We have a saying here for the habitat of the Sasquatch, and that is west of the Rockies. So you draw a line north to south, right down across there, the rim of the Rockies, and anything, all the evidence across the years, even the Native American evidence with the naming of these things by Native Americans, is all west of the Rockies. In other words, California, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. And in these days, it's Northern California, maybe the last 75 miles, not lower than that.
Yeah, I mean, it is, I think, like you referred to earlier, Peter, I think people just don't realise how much woodland and forest is out there. It is incredible when you see sort of an aerial flyover of the northwest of the United States and Canada. It is incredibly dense.
Yes, it's dense forest, and it is enormous. Out of Northern California, you have wilderness areas. You have one called the Marble Mountain Wilderness, 1 million acres. Mm. You have another one called Six Rivers National Forest, 1 million acres. Vast areas, hundreds of miles. And again, the U.S. government cleared this U.S. forest many, many years ago, maybe across the turn of the century, and have not allowed building of any kind, other than in the valleys and where the cities are. So most of it is deserted. The whole of the coast of British Columbia it's probably about 500 miles, had Native Americans living there, or Native Canadians living there at one time. But they all came into the cities. The government brought them in for education for their children and medical services, that kind of thing. That whole coast is deserted. And it's incredibly dense, and it has the four requirements that any creature requires. It has food, water, cover, and space. Food is in the form of the vegetation, hundreds of edible plants, and then space, plenty of cover in the form of forest. So, but we've had reports from Texas, Illinois, northern New York State, but none of them with any credibility at all, especially the skunk ape, that whole skunk ape thing. I say good luck to the fellows who were there. I think they had a lot of fun, but that's all.
So do you think that this is, you know, as you say, anything that side of the Rockies, do you think it's just a modern pop culture phenomenon in regard rather than credible cryptozoology?
Yes, it's people mistaking natural phenomena, seeing shadows at night, and they're thinking Bigfoot. And what was that? Is that one across the road? People finding footprints, but they don't have the expertise to examine. So basically, that's what it is. And there's some pranking going on, some joking going on. There's a fellow in New York State, and across 2 years, he put on a fursuit at night and ran across the highway through headlights until he was hit by a car and killed. And that was the end of the poor fellow. But he had a lot of fun doing that. And there are reports coming in all the time. A huge, hairy creature, not seen in northern New York State, running across the highway. And then he was hit by a car, and that was the end of him. So we use the word credible very carefully. Well, I sit down with someone who says he's an eyewitness, and he says to me, I say, have you ever seen one before? And he says, oh, yes, this is my sixth sighting. I don't want to talk to him. I don't have anything to do with him. There's no such thing. You can have one sighting. You might have two, but it's like winning the lottery. You might see one of these things one time, and you see them very briefly, because all they ever do is always the same pattern. They turn and walk away. Again, there's no sign of violence of any kind from the creatures, enormous though they may be. No women have been threatened, no children have been kidnapped, anything like that. So I think that sums up what I'm trying to put across to you.
No, absolutely. I think in that regards then, Peter, do you kind of, you know, from your experience, I mean, I always tend to take the word of experienced outdoorsmen or hunters as far more credible than, you know, as you refer to there, when you bump into people who claim to have seen it numerous times, like you say. I think it's like trying to, you know, catch lightning in a bottle for me. I think if you're lucky enough to see one of these creatures, like you say, it's an extremely rare event, and multiple sightings, I think, tends to push the boundaries of credibility.
Yes.
I mean,
no, the sightings, the eyewitnesses that I have interviewed and I regard as credible, every one of them has had one sighting only. And they'd love to have another sighting. That's because you spend 50 years out here and not have another sighting. There's a creature out here which you might say in some ways is as rare and as shy as a Bigfoot, and that's the mountain lion. Mm. We have a lot of mountain lions. But I've been in and out of the woods here now for 50 years, and I've seen one just one time. And then I meet people who live locally who have never seen one. They're nocturnal, they're very shy. So that's in a way you could compare that to Bigfoot sightings.
Absolutely. I mean, does your experience, Peter, going back to your time in India as, you know, big game, surely that alone gives you the knowledge and the experience to understand just how camouflaged and reclusive large predators can be. You know, tigers especially are incredibly clever at hiding in plain sight, you could say.
Yes.
So, I mean, obviously, when you refer to that, because of the terrain, it's quite easy to understand why these instances are as rare as they should be, if that makes sense.
Yes. Well, as I say, the terrain is enormous, and the only, there are main roads, of course, that run through here. A very great, wonderful road system. But up in the mountain country, it's just logging roads. And if people go up there to do a little searching, they like to go up in the daytime. They don't want to get stuck out at night. Nowadays, we all have cell phones, but there are many areas where there are no towers and cell phones don't work. So people can find their searching to lower areas and areas where their cell phones will work and they can be rescued if they get stuck. Mm. And at this time, though, I work with five other guys here, and our victory research consists of motion sensor cameras, and we have five cameras out at this time, and we have them out in an area where there have been credible sightings, and then we have them out there on what we call a geo-time pattern. Hmm. In other words, the sighting there, Area X in July, we have cameras there. The sighting at Area B in August, we'll have cameras there at that time. Because if one is passing through there in that month, it is doing so for a reason. The reason is probably food. Animals have reasons for their movements. We don't. We go and picnic in the forest and come back. No reason at all. But animals do, and it's mostly food. And it's extremely important to a mouse, to an elephant, food. And animals spend most of their time looking for food. So that's what we're doing right now. Some of the areas are gated off by logging companies, so we hike in. And we do this every 2 or 3 weeks. We check our cameras, check out the cards, and we are getting great pictures, pictures of deer, thousands of pictures of deer, elk, mountain lion, bear, porcupines, coyotes, small animals, thousands of pictures. The cameras are very good, very sensitive. So we need them out there, and that's the extent. I ran two big projects, as you know, and right now I'm out of it pretty much. It's a hobby for me. But my interest is still there, and then I enjoy getting out and hiking and camping overnight from time to time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, do you keep into, obviously you're still doing certain projects yourself, Peter, and like you say, for you now it's more of a hobby, but have you kind of kept yourself, because I've noticed that, you know, over the last few years you've done a few conferences and things, so how do you see cryptozoology now, obviously with the internet and obviously the growth in cryptozoology over the last sort of 10 years?
Well, my cryptozoology, you must understand, has been combined just two things, just the Yeti and Bigfoot, and nothing else. And right now, with technological advances are wonderful, the cameras that we have. There's some new cameras out now, and we're looking at buying one or two of those, and they will transmit pictures right back into the home here, into a television set from 50 miles away, 100 miles away. We're looking at using some of those. Again, drones have come up. They're incredible. Drones can go up and fly for hours, investigate areas. Were I to go back into something big, that's what I would be doing. But right now, I think I told you, it's just a hobby, and I enjoy getting out. And then the other thing we do is we keep in touch locally, and people know us. And right now we have three eyewitnesses to investigate. We're trying to find out where they are, get their telephone numbers. We heard each of them had very good sightings within recent years. So right now we're sort of laid back and taking it easy. And again, hoping that we might find remains one of these days.
Yeah. Well, I think if anybody deserves to take it easy, Peter, it's yourself after everything you've done for the whole subject. I mean, like I say, you're one of the first people I was ever aware of in regards to this as a young man out here in England. So do you think that the possibility that we're going to capture as we get these advances, do you think we're getting closer and closer to getting actual tangible proof, Peter?
I don't know how to answer that. Getting closer and closer. Nobody's doing anything. There are no projects. There are no expeditions. I thought for years that huge institutions like the Smithsonian would become interested and send teams out. And science, for the most part, is very, very cautious of the Bigfoot mystery. And over the years, we've had two scientists, one British, one American here, who endorsed it, came into the investigation with us, wrote books about it. But otherwise, science is very cautious. They call it taking the road to Loch Ness. And young scientists coming out of college, they say, now don't take the road to Loch Ness. Otherwise, don't have anything to do with the Loch Ness monster or with the Yeti or a Bigfoot. So on the whole, belief is growing a great deal here. And then the very good examinations have been done of that 1967 footage. And is this believed to be real? It's an extraordinary piece of footage. Mm. Sadly, it's very short.
Yes.
So on the whole, there is some scientific interest growing. But in the end, as I think I said earlier on, what science demands is a body on the table, physical remains. And that could happen. It could happen while I'm still here.
Yeah. Well, I hope it does, Peter. I mean, for you then, it's simply a case of we need someone to basically throw some money at this and get out there constantly, you know, going back to the length of time you were out there sort of searching for the Yeti and things, and just have a real concerted effort.
Yes, another project, in other words, you know, something like 5 years, good funding, use of the best technology can supply, drones, that kind of thing. That would be good. I would be interested. No, I'm not interested in joining it. Yes. I'm a little bit beyond. I've got into some other things. I prefer to relax a bit and keep it at a low key, as it were. So that could happen, and I'd be happy to be an advisor to something like that. There's talk of one right now, and it may come about.
Oh, well, I trust. I mean, it's one of those things, Peter. People always say to me here in the UK, what would you do if you won the lottery? And people scoff because I've said this for years. The first thing I would do would be, right, we're going to the northwest of the United States. Simple as that. And we would be out there, Peter. That would be my dream. You know what I mean? I'd buy a nice little house here in the UK and get some rescue animals, and the rest of the money I'd just pack up and we'd be off to Canada and North America looking for Bigfoot.
Okay.
So you would certainly be on my hit list of people to call for some guidance and such as. So, Peter, thank you for taking some time to speak to me. I know you're a very busy man. And where can people keep up with you? Have you still got your websites running?
I have a website running, and it's www.petercburn.com. Not Peter Byrne, Peter C. Byrne, my middle initial. And on that is a lot of information that people might like to have. And as I think you know, I've written and published 20 books, right up until recently, the last one, which is my autobiography. And all those books are on there. And if people are interested in buying them, they can reach me through that website and we can get books to them. So I'm selling a few books right now as part of what I'm doing. But the website is there. www.petercburn.com for anyone who wishes to get in touch with me.
Fantastic. Well, Peter, once again, thank you so much for taking some time to speak to me today. It's an absolute honour and a privilege. You're somebody I've looked up to for the best part of my life. So it's a real honour to get a chance to have a chat with you today. And once again, thank you for your time. Have a wonderful birthday later this week, and you take care.
Thanks. Thank you. And you win that lottery and come and join us.